Lisa?
Who is us?
I got to take a vacation. I got to go sit in meetings. And it was just at the time of the fire explosion. So, I mean, all the house members were on their cell phones and, you know, the email both with the figure out. I think that's about the time you and I was here.
You're
going
to have to try to have it. Everything is happening.
Oh, nice.
A real disaster. Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Well, you move up a notch in seniority.
It's all in the July 18th minute.
The Pension Commission will come to order. Today, I've invited the people that our first item on the agenda is the first chunk of the principles, and we're going to try to have a discussion on principles 1-4, which are part of page 1-11 of the memo of June 18th, I think it was. And anyone that wishes to talk, and at any point along the way may do so. And anyone that wants to really get into the discussion and add to our deliberations are invited to come down and sit at the table. But if you're shy, you can stay up there far away so I can hardly see you. But then you're going to have to indicate in some way that you want to participate if you want to participate. But feel free at any point. The first principle that we're going to go for just a minute. I got to find my note paper. There it is. The purpose of the Minnesota Public Pension Plans, and I think that in this discussion that's where we should start with talking about the word augmentation, which was in the memo quite a few times, and and then we probably should bring up the three-legged stool assumption that has been passed out many times. Pension plans, that are in addition to personal savings, in addition to Social Security, and nowhere does it ever say that the pension will supplement totally the income that was earned. And in the memo, several times, as I said, the word augment was used. And I think that's a good point. Is that, there any other points that have to be made about the purpose?
Oh, Madam Chair.
Senator Betz.
Then, as I'm looking at the memo here, then we have the purpose that's stated on page 1 of the memo, and then on page 3, there's proposed amendments. Are you suggesting that we hone in on one or the other right now, or what should we be?
We certainly can.
Okay.
Yes.
And I guess overall the pensions. I guess if historically were to allow somebody to work a whole lifetime and then
retire and never work again. And then this was going to be a means of their income when they're no longer working. That's certainly one of the main purposes of a pension. But I think we've seen many instances where people, because they move about through their career, are trying to use a pension not as a sole means of income when they're no longer working, but to supplement other retirement incomes. And I guess I'm trying to figure out how we can, you know, make all that consistent in one statement. And I'm trying to see if the proposed language would do that, or is that really one of our purposes? Or, you know, should we just be honing in on the people who, you know, work their whole career, retire, and then never plan to work again, which is at variance with some of the issues that we have coming before us?
That's true. And more it's going to be at variance, probably, because many people are finding out, especially in the pension plans, that where their working income wasn't so great, mm-hmm. and then they're living longer, and so it's harder and harder for them to live on what they saved, what they earned, what their Social Security, which is also based on what they earned, and then their pension income, and then they're getting to be older and they think, I need more money because health insurance has gone up.
Well, folks at the table, here's your chance.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things that I thought was helpful in one of the alternatives, it looks like it's 2A1. I don't know. It looks like there's two of them to me. But where it seems to address that changing demographics that you alluded to. And I think that could be a move in the right direction.
And at this point, you said the word demographics. We have asked the state demographer to come, but the choice of dates that I gave him wasn't very helpful. So we're still working.
Thank you.
He's willing. Mm-hmm. He's willing. But evidently a busy man in the summer. So,
yeah.
Mr. Bergstrom?
Madam Chair, from our perspective, we're comfortable with the policy that currently exists. Of the two on page 3, we prefer the second one. But we're also comfortable with current pension policy.
And by we, does that mean this MSRS or all four of you?
For the record, we is the statewide retirement systems.
Okay.
And we cannot speak for Mr. Stoffel. Even though we would like to. Yes.
He's capable for himself.
and I think the one thing that kind of we looked at is under A3 being kind of one of your critical things is as public employees develop, public pension plans should be sufficiently flexible to make necessary adaptations. And as we went through the principles, we thought that one is an important one to keep in mind. As you know, last session, the teachers have a different return to work provision than MSRS and PERA. You made some decisions that were probably very appropriate that we think are covered under that flexibility statement. So as you look at the policy, I think our overriding thought was, you know, these are high-level policies, and some of the suggestions try to tighten it down to the point where it may be more than policy. It might be kind of just putting in what has happened. And I think that will be one of the comments that we will see consistently from us anyway, is, you know, these are policies, not just necessarily reaction to what was passed over the last 4 or 5 years.
Mr. Martin, the memo is proposing 2A1 and the top paragraph, and then the on page 3, and then the second paragraph on the purpose. And what does one do without the other?
Madam Chair, members, on page 3, the version that's page 3, lines 1 through 8, basically eliminates the out-transitioning item as a purpose, replacing it with a phase-out item, or the new version or the alternative on page 3, lines 9 through 17, retains out-transitioning and adds in phasing out of employees. Historically, employers set up pension plans in part to know when they're going to have workforce changes, when people are about to retire, so that they can then recruit and replace people. Once upon a time, there were mandatory retirement provisions that were permitted, which very clearly allowed the employer to plan for transitions, to recruit new staff, to replace staff that was about to retire, because they controlled to a greater extent when people had to retire, and with their pension program, controlled when they probably could most early retire. Caught the parameters of when they needed to replace folks. With the doing away with most or all mandatory retirement provisions in federal legislation starting in the late 60s and continuing into the 80s, that part of out transitioning has been diminished. So there is no mandatory retirement permitted. Recently, especially with the change in the teacher programs, where individuals can basically agree to continue employment after they make a nominal termination to retire, essentially shifting from full-time employment or whatever their prior employment was to part-time without and drawing a pension at the same time they're teaching, that I think, to my mind, raises the question of just how much out transitioning really still is a purpose. If the trend is to be individuals not making a clean break with employment, but continuing employment in some sort of moderated or diminished quantity, that's sizably different than having people leave employment and providing a full replacement or a considerable replacement of their prior economic resources at that one point in time. So that's why we focused on whether the out-transitioning was to be retained as a purpose or essentially replaced by a phase-out. Clearly, you're permitting phase-outs, so I think something ought to, or it seems appropriate to reference phasing out in some fashion. It's really a question of how much you want to. Does phasing out replace the more straightforward out transitioning function, or is it to be working in tandem to some extent? So that's why we created the two alternative possible changes that are on page 3.
But at this time, and when we were discussing that, we didn't have any idea that there would be a whole lot of people doing that. Did the fund directors have any idea of how many people have requested this in the past, the phasing out, or the to work after they retired?
Ma'am.
I know for a couple of years ago we had a big discussion on it with school superintendents, and that's still going on. Now they get scarcer and scarcer, but Ms. Vanek?
Madam Chair and members, Mary Vanek, PERA Director. I just had a meeting with the League of Minnesota Cities Personnel Committee yesterday, and they are asking us to work with them on developing a two-pronged approach, possibly both a phased retirement opportunity so they can incent people to stay on longer, even if it means reducing hours, and also a return to work opportunity for people who are retired so they have a pool of resources to go to for temporary or special project work. And I've also been in touch with the counties, and they are interested in joining in that development of that issue. So we currently have about 2,500 of our coordinated plan members who have returned to work. We have about 800 police and fire members who have returned to work after retirement. So we are seeing those numbers increase, and creating these other alternatives will simply, you know, facilitate more of that, which the demographer will tell you, we need to keep these people somehow engaged in the workforce. So we need opportunities created to do that within the law.
Well, Sarah Benzel.
Madam Chair, I think the second amendment language is probably more realistic to what I've been hearing not only today but on this commission. In fact, just this past week, I was at a retirement ceremony for a Hennepin County deputy sheriff who's already talking about what he's going to be doing next. Okay, he's retiring under the rule of 90. He probably is getting too old at age 58 to be doing the sheriff work, but he's not too young to retire. But he wants to phase out the full-time working career that he's had and do something else. So I think that the purpose statement as we have it doesn't quite recognize that is. And as I indicated earlier, I think that we have to recognize that there are some folks that are going to out-transition and they're conclude their working career, and the others who are just going to phase out what they're doing now as a full-time employee with whatever comes later on. And I think we have to recognize that both are in play here, or at least those are the issues that seem to come at us.
And if we didn't make any change to the principle and left it like it is on page one, they could still be phasing out, could they not? Or is this just the second part, 9 through 17 on page 3, does that add to the phasing out?
Well, Madam Chair, I think that in my view, I think that the language talking about who are nearing the normally expected conclusion of their full-time working career, full-time, has the implication that there might be something other than full-time ahead. Whereas I think that the principal statement as we have it now talks about out-transitioning of existing public employees at the normally expected conclusion of their working careers. I think it could still work in the people that still plan to retire and then move on to something else, but I don't know that it's that you almost have to, you know, kind of read that and assume it. And as I say, I think we're dealing with two different groups here, the ones that are not going to work at all and the ones that plan to keep working but just in a different capacity. if that's the purpose of pensions. Now we could tighten up what a pension purpose really is, but that isn't going to change the issues that come before us. People want to have it a different way.
Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
If I understand the Senator's answer to your question, have we dealt with the question of the word that Mr. Martin used, and that is the word trend? Currently, we the legislature views pensions as out-transitioning. When one or five or 20 constituents come before us, we grant often exceptions to the rule. Are we going to deal with the question that we want to now recognize we're setting a trend, that we're trendsetters, or we're just granting exceptions? Therefore, do we want to keep the language as it is and keep within the purview of the legislature the sole authority to make exceptions, rather than now recognizing a phasing issue and making that part of the general rule? Do we want to leave the language as it is and therefore retain legislative authority to grant exceptions rather than opening the so-called floodgates?
Madam Chair, if I can, and it's an excellent point that Representative Smith makes. I mentioned, I think, at the last meeting that prior to being in the legislature, I spent a number of years, on my city's planning and zoning commission and chaired it. And my city in Fridley happened to be built at a time in the mid-60s when everybody built their house in the middle of the lot with a single-car garage. And unfortunately, by the time it changed in the 80s, when I was on this planning commission, people wanted two-car garages, except because the houses were in the middle of the lot, to expand it, you'd have to go too close to the lot line, which is specifically prohibited by the ordinance. And so we spent lots of time over and over and over on these variance requests, and ultimately, finally, we just threw our hands up and suggested to the city council, why don't you change the ordinance, because this is clearly the direction we're going in. I don't know if we're clearly in that direction yet, it is there. It does sort of seem to me that we are dealing with, a number of employees, who are, going to be retiring at an age where they plan and expect to go on later on. I mean, I think that there's some people who will work until, they can't physically work anymore, and that's it. Whether or not we've quite reached that point, as Representative Smith suggested, I'm not sure myself. But I think we've certainly seen evidence that there are people who are going to certainly get requests in here from people who want to find ways to work in that second career after retiring from the full-time first career. And I don't know whether we should treat them as exceptions or just recognize that that's what's going on, and maybe we just don't have the evidence of that yet.
Madam Chair, on that point, I also was on a planning commission while I was mayor, and it seems to me that if you move the setback line closer to the property line, there's always going to be somebody wanting to get even closer.
Exactly.
And I'd rather do it. Yeah. Question, not me personally, but would we rather do it by exception down the road rather than by setting a wider general rule right now?
Well,
any other comments to that question? Mr.
Stoffel.
Stoffel.
Jay.
Mr. Jay.
Madam Chair, maybe to help Representative Smith a little bit in the question and the rest of the commission members, I guess in my experience in the last 5 years, I guess 6 years, in administering the Duluth Teacher Pension Fund, it's been very apparent that people are working longer because of the cost of health care insurance. I think that's the pretty well established fact, but we can document that with figures and the trend to working beyond the rule of 90. 10 years ago, people would hit the rule of 90 and they would retire, and that was the question on their mind. When do I hit the rule of 90? They would hit the rule of 90 and they would retire. Now people are working 2, 3, 4 years beyond the rule of 90. So I think it is a trend that people are working longer, and it seems it's directly related to the cost of healthcare insurance. So to help answer the question about whether you do this as an exception or build it into the policy, I guess the argument to put it into the policy is to recognize the fact that this is, in my observation anyway, from where I see things in our local fund, it is a trend. It is something that's going to stay with us for a while until the question of healthcare insurance, I think, not only in the state but in the nation, is developed and addressed. So I guess my response would be it seems to be a good thing to put it in the policy as to acknowledge the reality that has occurred in the last 5, 6 years.
Representative,
yeah, Madam Chairman, I guess the reason I would like to put it into policy is that I think that it's good public policy. We're seeing again and again that we need to have people keep on working. I mean, I think one of the things which I was once led to believe was good public policy and voted for it, I'm sure, innumerable times until the numbers came together and I saw it wasn't, was the concept of early retirement and incentives for early retirement and the belief that that was a great money-saving advice. But this is, I think, when we can align pension policy with what makes sense for public policy, I frankly think that we ought to do it. And I'm not sure that we see much, we need to work on the problem of the shortage, particularly the kinds of people who get public pensions, those are the kinds of people that I think we're most lacking in terms of qualifications in the workforce that we need. And so so I think that we need to take the steps to encourage it, not just on a case-by-case basis.
I'm sure.
And
again, as I'm reading through what, it'd be one thing if the purpose of the pension was to be able to simply provide a source of income for the retiree, so that the retiree would not, need any, further assistance, and it'd be sufficient to live, adequately, but the purpose of the pensions has been to augment their compensation, and it has. And we do recognize in our current statement that the purpose is to be in combination with things like Social Security coverage, savings, financial resources, so that it's adequate and affordable. So, to that extent, I think that if we were to recognize the individuals who are phasing out their full-time employment, the pension is there to augment what they are going to be receiving, and the day will come when they are going to have to retire permanently. But they're using their pension from their first position in the combination with their other resources. And as I'm thinking about it, I think that the second one, can be adopted as a as something that would be reflect the purpose of the pensions, without necessarily setting the making a statement that makes it more than it is intended to be.
Madam Chair,
Representative Smith,
if we recognize or replace existing language with the trend-setting, phasing-out approach, would we obviate the necessity of this commission meeting so much?
Maybe.
We're still going to have bills.
Oh, you really didn't want them to have.
No, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, the question is withdrawn.
Does anybody want to make a recommendation? Sarah Lynch?
Madam Chair, I would make a motion that we amend the policy to reflect the language on page 3, lines 9 through 17.
Any further discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted. We did it. We did one.
Hey. There you go.
Only what? 6 words? A dozen words?
14 left. Principal B. For Principal 2B, creation of new pension plans. Oh, Mr. Martin, this one's so big.
Madam Chair, I think this is more of a catch-up rather than a clear change. To some extent, that this is reflecting what has been your actual actions over time. I think because of the historic nature of the commission and some of the past concerns of commission members, there was a strong reaction to our multiplicity of local pension plans back when the Pension Commission was first created, many of those plans being in relatively poor financial and actuarial shape. And there was a long tradition or long discussion and conflict within the Pension Commission over what to do with the proliferation of local pension plans in the state, starting sometime in the mid-60s and beginning to culminate in 1980 when most of the local police and paid fire plans were put on a phase-out basis. And so there was a strong statement historically as part of the Pension Commission's principles that we should not be creating additional pension plans. There also was a reflection that we had a large number of volunteer fire plans and that is a decentralized system of pension coverage, and that perhaps some concentration on a still decentralized basis made sense. So I think that's why the two statements in the current policy suggest that there shouldn't be the creation of new pension plans. And that if there are going to be new pension plans for volunteer firefighters, they should be organized somewhat more centrally or regionally if possible. Since then, there have been on some occasions the creation of new plans, and in looking at those, trying to figure out why the commission undoubtedly created those new plans, and this starts on page 4, I've identified four reasons why either we were incorporating new public employers or that the retirement coverage for certain groups was general employee pension plan coverage and it was deemed inappropriate or inadequate for public employees who are not clearly purely general employee plan types, but were closer to public safety type plans because of the nature of their employment, or three, as a vehicle to allow for the consolidation of various pension plans, or four, to provide supplemental pension plan coverage. And so the suggestion for new language on page six, and the reason why I've only given you one suggestion, is that the language here attempts to capture in a somewhat formal way what seems to be the operating principles of the commission over the past 20 or 30 years, that if new pension plans are to be created, that they fall into one of those four reasons. The other thing that the new language does at the very bottom of the page, the new item C on lines 12 through 15, is to also take notice of the recent work in trying to create a voluntary statewide volunteer fire pension plan, which wasn't contemplated back in the mid-90s.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, Mr. Martin, I do have a question on page 6 on subparagraph A. You're keeping pretty much the same language, including the last clause, except for Volunteer Firefighter Relief Association. So as I read the current language, and even as we were to keep it, it does somehow seem to suggest that the sentence says that we should not have new pension plans without legislative authorization, except for volunteer. Well, I think that we should strike that last clause, because I'd rather not have new firefighter relief associations being created without somehow our knowledge. We've already got plenty of them as it is. I think that the new paragraph C does reflect the direction that we've talked about going into, trying to consolidate some of them into some larger organizations, so we don't have the 800 or so out there that we really don't have a good handle on. So is there a reason why we want to keep that last clause, except for volunteer firefighter relief associations, in A, as opposed to just striking that and leaving C as you have it proposed?
Mr. Martin.
Madam Chair, Senator, A is really a reflection of the status of the situation of current law.
Right.
Volunteer fire plans can be created by local government on their own initiative.
Okay.
And so I didn't suggest any change in that, because there has not been any legislation to change that situation. Mm-hmm. This is the statement coming out of the 95-96 working group on the policy principles, and still reflects current law. The nature of this project was is to try and derive from the things that you've done in recent years that are somewhat at variance with the principles, to see whether a new statement of principles better accommodates your perspective, since there hasn't been any move to change the authority of local government to create new volunteer fire plans. I did not address that. Doesn't mean that it isn't worth, and it doesn't prohibit you from raising the possibility of changing the principles or pursuing that, but it seemed outside the purview of what we were trying to do here, which was to accommodate the principles better to our developments recently.
But
then that raises a different question then, though, because the principles presumably are here to guide us to fill in those areas of the statute to help us be consistent. You have statutes which the legislature can change it, anytime it deems to do so. But if we want to be able to over the years to be able to follow a set of rules and not just have it decided by just who happens to be on the pension commission at a given moment. That's what we need the principles for. So what does even the full paragraph A accomplish if that's already in statute? How does that help guide us in what we can or cannot, should or should not do as we're recommending consistent pension policy? Is there anything else in A that, you know, I mean, it nice be to remind us what the statute says, but does it really matter to us other than just to tell us, is this what's in law?
I think, Senator, it's a statement that you have a general dislike for the creation of new pension plans, especially pension plans that are more than just a volunteer fire plan where the underlying employment is basically emergency on-call duties and not regular employment. Yeah. So it does stand as some statement of the historic dislike or lack of affection for creation of additional pension plans. But you are correct that it's more stating current law.
Sure.
That the commission has been successful in prohibiting the creation of new pension plans in the main, and this doesn't add much then to the success that the commission has had in the past in eliminating the creation of new plans.
And then, Madam Chair, and then Mr. Martin, then, is it possible then if we left A as it is to just add something that, except for volunteer firefighter relief associations, created by local government or something comparable, so that as future pension commissions read that principle, they're reminded that it would be the local government creating those firefighter relief plans, not us. That they can still pop up, but that's where they're going to come from.
Senator, in the main, I suppose that's how local volunteer fire plans usually would be created, because mm-hmm. most volunteer fire plans are municipal fire departments or cover municipal fire departments. And most of the volunteer fire plans are lump sum defined benefit plans where the municipality has to approve the level of pension coverage to be provided or essentially no or only nominal coverage could be provided. But there we do have this, well, volunteer fire plans, for better or for worse, are nonprofit corporations mm-hmm. under Minnesota law and organized by the firefighters, not the local government. Mm-hmm. So the volunteer fire plan actually does get set up by the volunteer firefighters, even where the municipality sets up the fire department. We also have the somewhat analogous circumstance of independent nonprofit firefighting corporations, where a number of individuals in an area that's not served by a fire department can organize their own fire department, contract with one or more municipalities, townships, governmental entities, and the corporation is the fire department and a subsidiary corporation is the volunteer fire pension plan. So unfortunately, if we would, the statement or the policy principle would be at variance with the current state law, which does permit, in effect, individuals, not just governments. Government usually would be involved, but is not in every instance.
But then, Madam Chair, Mr. Martin, then the A isn't entirely consistent there either, because it says Minnesota public employers on their own initiative should not be permitted except for volunteer firefighter relief association. And as I understand what you're saying is that, well, it's not just the employers, it's a lot of other ways that they can be created. So the statement is not even consistent, because it's more than just the public employers we're talking about. It's a whole host of other things that can create them. I mean, the point that you're trying to make is that volunteer fire relief associations can pop up anywhere beyond our control because the statute allows that. So I'm just saying that I don't know that the paragraph is entirely clear as to what our role is, except that maybe we just need a separate line, or maybe you could go into C, the fact that these things are going to happen, but where feasible, we should try to consolidate them. So maybe that just needs a little bit of modification in that one.
Representative Kahn.
Yes, Madam Chairman, a couple of points. First, I guess I have a question, which is, have any new volunteer fire plans been formed in recent years? And other than the joining of two, is what?
Madam Chair,
Mr.
What is it?
Ms. Kahn, my understanding is yes. I can't tell you how many, but Ms. Hennessy Allen here from the Office of the State Auditor may be able to give us a rough-hewn count. But information I've seen, there are volunteer fire plans that have been in existence for less than a couple of years, which means they were formed recently.
Ms. Hennessy Allen?
Madam Chair, members, Rose Hennessy Allen, Office of the State Auditor. We have seen between one and three new relief associations formed each of the past few years. We do have some that are forming each year.
And they're not consolidations? They're
no, new ones formed mostly covering smaller communities in greater Minnesota.
Growing communities?
Small communities.
Well, Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, I think one of the things, of course, that I've been focused on is the last number three at the bottom of page three. And, that's the direction that I thought we should go consistently. So it's kind of funny to see it as a, when the purpose of that is to get rid of, hopefully, 400 pension plans or something like that, it's kind of funny to see it as listed as a violation of the principle, or possible violation of the principle of forming new pension plans. But I actually think that we should maybe waiting for this. I mean, it was hard to believe that forming a voluntary advisory board was a step forward in something that I've been working on for at least 10 or 15 years or something. But, I think that pending this, we ought to get rid of, the least controversial thing that we do ought to be to prohibit new ones from forming unless they go into this plan and so forth. So I think we should, and let me just say that we don't have to look. Every pension bill we pass changes state law. So the principals, don't ever have to defer to state law. That means that we're looking at redoing state law in accordance with the principles. So I think, I don't know what to do at this point. I would like to... I kind of hoped that the answer to that question was no, that there weren't any new ones being formed. I guess at least you can say the answer is not many, and it would be the interesting, were these new fire departments formed, or were they fire departments that didn't have a pension plan, or what, what's the characteristics of those?
Madam Chair, Representative
Zellin.
In a few of the cases, they were actually new fire departments that were formed, but in other cases, they were existing fire departments and just had never formed a relief association, just didn't have enough interest locally or just didn't quite get it formed.
But, I'm not sure what I want to do about changing this now without getting involved in the whole, subverting this voluntary advisory board. But what's happening? What's happening with that? Well, I would if we could just eliminate and just do the whole thing by law and
we
do it
can't.
All right here today.
We're not going
I would be
to
really,
do that.
I would be really happy.
Going to do that.
I would be really happy if we would do that. But does anyone know what's happening with this?
Ms. Vanek?
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, we have our first meeting next Monday afternoon.
Ooh. So I guess my suggestion is that before making changes in either the principle or the law, that we wait and see what this does. And hopefully if they do something that looks like it's going to work well, I think then the first thing we ought to do is prohibit the forming of new ones. But the point is, if people think that it's necessary to have a pension plan for voluntary firefighters, it seems harsh to prohibit them from forming one when other people have them. But if there's another place for them to go, that would make sense to me.
Madam Chair, we focused on the firefighters, I guess, because of my inquiries here, but we had not touched on paragraph B on page 6, and as I read through that, a lot of those principles do seem to make sense, because although we do not want to create any more and certainly unneeded pension plans, we've certainly had situations where some people were just in the wrong plan that didn't fit. When we build a new prison, we have to make sure that the people are, have the right plan in place. And I can think of instances, I think, as the memo identifies, where we've just had issues where we weren't really creating a new plan, but we were trying to accommodate the situation that was before us and not force somebody into a plan that wasn't working. So I think B does seem to accomplish that. I don't know if we have any comments from others on that, but as for B, I'm generally okay with that.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, just a concern there. In dealing with the expansion of the correctional plan and the fire marshal's plan, I'm not sure if by including that you're not kind of opening up a can of worms. I get calls on a regular basis saying my pension is inadequate or inappropriate. I think the policy is we don't want to create any new programs, and I'm just afraid this might draw more attention to people saying, well, we should create this new plan for this group and this group and that group. And so I just bring that up as a concern.
And that comes up, would come about because we've been, what Senator Wetzel alluded to was, we've been adding people to plans because in most cases it's been a better deal than what they already had.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier retirement in some cases, many cases, and comparison of jobs or what they've done is made their case for their job is as stressful or whatever as the people that already have that benefit. So there's been a difference in benefits that they've been trying to attain, not necessarily a new plan, but they've been trying to get into a different plan.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator,
to that extent, and Mr. Bergstrom, I would think that the issue that could create a problem, as you're suggesting, is the language that's to correct inadequate or inappropriate prior retirement coverage that cannot be accommodated within an existing public retirement plan, because we do have people every year that come before us in the corrections area, for example, that say, well, I have contacts with inmates, therefore I should get early retirement. And we go through that exercise every year trying to figure out, who should qualify. And I'm sure there's a lot of people that says, I want to correct my inadequate or inappropriate retirement coverage because I'm not getting enough. So is that the language that you are identifying as the things that you would be concerned? I'm not sure that the other language would be, but I'm trying to determine where your issues were.
Madam Chair, Senator Wetzel, I think what this is talking about is not adding people to the correctional plan, mm-hmm. but creating another new plan.
Right.
And, so for the group that just doesn't quite make the correctional plan, they may want something not quite the correctional plan, but not the general employee's retirement plan. Anytime you move a group closer to something, you're going to get another group of employees who want something different. And I'm just concerned that in policy, you know, if you're talking about the creation, I think you're going to get a lot of people pointing to this policy saying, well, I might not be a correctional plan member, but I certainly should have some other benefit set. And it could proliferate into a lot of different pension plans. And that's my concern. Sometimes being left unsaid might be better than explicitly stating that.
And we do have the letter in our packets from Sherry Munyon on behalf of the probation officers.
Well, Madam Chair.
We don't.
Oh, go
ahead. Oh, we don't. Okay.
I guess we had it last time.
What? Madam Chair.
Sarah Betzel.
Again, if I'm looking at when I'm looking at B, obviously, if people are newly incorporated in the public sector, or if we're trying to consolidate existing plans, or providing supplemental coverage which cannot be accommodated, you know, I think those are things that, you know, could be pretty standard or things that, you know, would be understood. But I think that other the statement about correcting inadequate or inappropriate prior retirement coverage, it's subjective, and I think that people could hook onto that to say, I have inadequate pension coverage. So therefore, you know, that's in your principle says that, and I want better pension coverage. So, and I think that could wind up coming back and biting us in a way we would rather not have. So I think that would be a troublesome issue there. Well, we've done it. You know, we've had people and we've tried to accommodate that, but maybe that's something we may want to handle as a case-by-case basis rather than putting that as part of our principles.
Senator Larson.
Madam Chair, well, my question was the same as Senator or Representative Connell. This is related to the exception for volunteer fire relief associations, and I think that point that, and I know Representative Connell is gone, but.
Right there.
Oh, there she is. Where is she? Doesn't matter. I think the answer to the question was important because the fact that it's not 15 a year, but it's one or two or three, I think. The information we got from the state auditor's office means that there isn't a huge amount of activity in that area. So that was the point that I was seeking.
And is it, there aren't other new plans except for firefighters, right? Am I correct? Are there other people talking about new plans? Ms. Vanek?
Madam Chair, members, there was discussion a few years ago about something for dispatchers and post-sentencing officers, and I believe that Ms. Munyon is working with the post-sentencing officers, probation officers. And it's a question of, does this open up the door to the creation of a new plan versus are there other ways to accommodate some of the benefit provisions that they would like enhanced for their group? That you could maybe accommodate, it'd be complex, but maybe accommodate through the existing plan. For example, prior to the creation of the local government correctional plan, you did allow for a higher level disability benefit for correctional officers participating in PARA's general plan. We collected a higher contribution rate and they qualified for a different disability benefit, but all other aspects of our general plan still applied to them. So there are other ways other than creating a brand new pension plan.
And that could also be discussed under the item 3 on our agenda in the study if we're going to go beyond teachers.
Madam Chair, yes.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, and if you know, under A of that same policy, it's really saying don't create these own plans without legislative authorization. And then if you go up to A3 where it says they need to be flexible, I think the current policy really allows you the authority, if you so choose, to offer them and be flexible without specifically stating it in a policy. It's not that you're prohibiting the creation of new plans. It's, you know, you have the legislative authority, plus you have some flexibility to meet workforce trends.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is certainly a case where less is best. And I think the discussion has been really good. But at this point in time, I, having heard all of the discussion, I think that it would be too early to adopt some of the language as noted in Section C with regard to the volunteer firefighters. And I would agree with the many comments that were made with regard to Section B. I think that that will be a little bit more than we bargained for. So I guess that I'm suggesting that staff has done a good job of giving us some things to think about in this area, but I would move that no changes be made to this section of the guidelines.
Well, Madam Chair?
Senator Petzl.
Perhaps we can, you know, look at some revisions to the language. You don't need to adopt anything or reject anything at this moment, but, you know, as discussions go on, you know, we may come back, circle back to this one and say that, you know, we may have some ideas that, you know, might, you know, we can adopt. I think there's some things in here that are probably good, but we're clearly not at the point I think we can adopt anything right now. So, you know, maybe we should just keep an open mind and see what we can work out of it.
Before we leave this principle entirely, there, on page 4, we talked about defined benefit plan and defined contribution plans. And I was told that the pension plan directors went to a conference and there was talk about federal law perhaps being changed to talk more about defined contribution plans rather than benefit plans. Is that a trend? Did you learn that, or do you want to talk about that, or should I forget it? Because I really like defined benefit plans, and I don't particularly endorse contribution plans.
Madam Chair, Laurie Hacking with TRA. I'll try to respond to your question and the issue. First of all, we'd like to say this principle is excellent. We support it. Would like to see it continued. That is the expressed preference for defined benefit plans and maintaining them. The information that we've been gathering from our national organizations are clearly showing that defined benefit plans in the private sector are on the decline, and that decline has been hastened by a fairly dramatic change in the accounting standards used, which private sector employers are forced to use for their defined benefit plans. There is some discussion right now about making public sector defined benefit plans use those same accounting rules. And that's really the concern that we have, and would certainly like to give you more information if you're interested about that. We are, shall we say, coalescing together to work with the Government Accounting Standards Board, as well as some other entities that have jurisdiction over this area, to urge them not to put those accounting standards on to public sector plans. And because if that were to occur, it would dramatically increase required contribution rates for our plans. And just a real short comparison of what's going on here. In the private sector, the federal government is really concerned about corporations going out of business, potentially going out of business, merging, et cetera, which does happen very frequently in the private sector these days. And as a consequence of that concern, there is a push to make them fund their pension plans more fully and on a more immediate termination basis. Whereas in the public sector, governments are not going to go away or be dissolved, merged, very unlikely. We are large systems. We're multi-employer systems. So we are we have very long-term horizons. We expect to be in business hundreds of years from now. And there is less of a need to kind of force us to fund on a more immediate termination basis because we're not likely to terminate. So that's the, in a very big picture way, that's the debate that is going on. And the three pension systems will be engaging pretty vigorously in that debate with GASB and other accounting standard setting boards to encourage them to really maintain the way we currently have our accounting rules set up, because we think that makes sense for us and that we should not be forced to adhere to a private sector model that would be really ill-advised and inappropriate. I'm sorry.
How much of the standards changing or the accounting changes are being pushed by the people that sell and make money off of the various incentives that are being considered?
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, that's difficult to determine, but it is quite true that the private sector accounting standard changes have caused private sector plans to go into investing models that are called liability-driven investing, and it causes them to put very large portions of their portfolios into bonds because of the stability of the returns, the stability that it introduces into both matching of assets and liabilities. And, yes, there are many vendors which sell those liability-driven investing products. And, it's possible that they would like to see this sort of change. But it's hard to, mm-hmm. hard to pinpoint that. We think that would be very bad, again, for our pension systems. Because we have very long-term funding horizons, we can be significantly invested in equities and therefore over long periods of time have much higher rates of return than what we would get from a bond-dominated portfolio.
Thank you. Any further discussion on the Lynch motion, Senator Lynch motion? All in favor say aye.
Yeah.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. 2B3, consolidation of plans. Mr. Martin.
Members here, the pieces of legislation that are cited are instances where phase-outs of local plans were delayed by a change in a trigger device at which time the local plan would change to a municipal trust fund. And that's the two Minneapolis plan changes, and then the other two related to volunteer fire plans, where there was authority for consolidations, but not on a regional or a county basis, but simply planned by plan consolidations in presumably smaller geographic confines, or the creation of the statewide plan, which is, well, not inconsistent with the broad thrust of a more rational public pension plan structure, was not deemed as possible back in the 90s and was not contemplated by the current principles. So the principal change that we're suggesting would better accommodate with recent actions is on the top of page 9, adding some language about decentralized government structures, which seems to be the reason why we have the multiplicity of volunteer fire plans, and then talking about consolidating smaller plans into appropriately situated larger plans, and then adding a new item having to do with phase outs, but providing for the actual triggering and the actual manner in which the phase out would occur to be done on a case by case basis.
Pension plan directors that have sub-plans, do having fewer sub-plans make your life easier or more difficult? What's your experience, Mr. Bergstrom?
Madam Chair, fewer is always easier than more. You know, just over time, you have, you know, we administer 8 different defined benefit plans, and each of them have unique benefit structures, so you have to program your computers. So clearly, you know, there is the fewer, the better. However, I think the Pension Commission has done a pretty nice job of consolidating the pension plans where appropriate. You know, we have the local police and fire plans merged into the Public Employees Retirement Association. The Minneapolis Teachers was merged when it was appropriate with the Teachers Retirement Association. So kind of our thought on this one, I believe that A, 3A is kind of a negative statement. I infer from that we're irrational, that the structure that we have is irrational. And if you take away volunteer pension plans, we actually have a relatively rational pension plans system in Minnesota. You know, when you compare it to other states and other places, we have over time been actually shrinking the number of plans. And I just think A isn't necessarily really a policy, it's more of a statement. And from my standpoint, I think it's a little negative, and maybe I'm sensitive because I work in a public pension plan. But, you know, I think the commission has done a nice job of consolidation over time. And either that could be said more positively or be dropped, because I don't think it really adds from a policy standpoint.
We're on page 9, and on paragraph A, Mr. Martin, could you clarify again that second part of the sentence that is added, balancing the state's commitment to decentralized government structures? I think you said that recognizes the firefighter pension plans. And again, for those who think that we ought to have fewer of them, should we be putting in our principles that we recognize a commitment to keep decentralizing when some of us probably don't want to do that? So,
Senator
Mr. Martin,
members, Senator, what I was trying to do is to reflect what has been your apparent view, in based on looking at the legislation that you have enacted. You've created a board that might create a statewide volunteer fire plan, And we've done a number of other things with respect to volunteer fire plans that have buttressed or augmented their funding and made it more possible for even smaller and smaller places to have volunteer fire plans by increasing their fire state aid. So in trying to reconcile or trying to capture what must be, what may be somewhat contradictory or somewhat conflicting views that, do drive policy, we've tried to do that by suggesting that, yes, you would like a smaller number of plans, but you, the state obviously has some commitment with a fairly large number of local governmental units and especially a large number of local government plans in the form of volunteer fire plans. There's some commitment still remaining to decentralize government in the state.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Martin, so that second part of the sentence is only for the volunteer firefighters. Is that what's as reflecting the decentralized government structures? Or is it beyond that?
Senator, I think it's primarily for the volunteer fire okay. plans, but I think we also have some local full-time employee pension plans, and then, there's no active movement to do anything about those plans. We do still organize our statewide plans to some extent on levels of government notion, with statewide plans being with one plan administration and local government pension coverage by other statewide plans, which reflects a decentralization of government, or a reflection that we have a decentralized government.
Well, Madam Chair, just from my own thoughts, I'm not sure that I would want to say that I have a commitment to decentralizing some of the plans, because I think in some cases they probably ought to be more centralized than they are right now. I may have a recognition that that's the way it is, and you know, obviously, well, as Representative Conn has indicated, we could probably just, you know, consolidate them if we passed a law to do so, but as the chair has indicated, we're not going to. So I have to recognize the fact that that the recognition of the status that we have isn't necessarily a commitment that that's what it has to be. So I think I may have just a bit of a different take as to, you know, how I would like to see that worded. But okay, thank you.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I looked at this particular principle, I had a couple of thoughts. One, in Section A, while I realize that for the most part, much of that is in our existing principle, frankly, when I read Section A, the immediate thought that came to my mind and has stuck with it since is that I really feel good, bad, or indifferent that this is really a political statement. So that concerns me. As I looked further into this policy, or this principle rather, it seems to me that if we really focus on what is it that the commission is trying to convey here? What is it, what's the heart of the matter? The heart of the matter, I think, is in Section B, where we talk about this consolidation of plans. So I think that the language on page 9, lines 6 through 10, actually strengthens the intent of this principle. And then looking at Section C, I would hope, I think that reflects the work that the commission has most recently conducted, but I also think, and I'd be interested in knowing if the plan administrators would concur or not, but I would think that going forward, if I were a public pension plan or particularly an administrator, that I'm favorable towards that language in Section C, because it may not necessarily be one size fits all. And I think that it is, and when issues like that come before us, that it is incumbent upon the commission to look at those very individually. So those are some of my comments.
Mr. Koppler?
Madam Chair, if I may, I think the first paragraph probably reads okay, I mean, from our perspective, and likewise, paragraph C. Paragraph B, well, and this principle, 2B3.
Are we talking on page 9 now?
Yes.
Okay.
At the top. I mean, this is really a policy preference more so than a principle. I don't think that this principle really lays out or sets forth what the public policy objective is to be achieved by establishing this guideline or criterion for looking at proposals that come before you or initiatives that you undertake. And I think, I mean, that could be amended by modifying paragraph B with a statement setting forth what the policy objective is. And it could be achieving economies of scale. It could be enhancement of services. It could be delivery of more cost-effective or the provision of more secure benefits for members. Something preamble to that effect in that paragraph, stating what the policy is, what the policy objectives are through consolidation to be achieved, because I'm not sure that fewer plans is necessarily a better construct. Larger plans are not necessarily more efficient. This economy is the scale occur in service-type organizations at a fairly early stage. So, I mean, typically there has to be some other objective for consolidation. And your objective may be consistency of policy across employee units in different jurisdictions. That's a valid public policy objective, if that's what you're after, but I don't think it's stated here or made clear.
Mr. Stoffel.
Madam Chair, my take on the lines 1 through 14 on the top of page 9, I would concur with Mr. Bergstrom's comments and Senator Lynch's comments about paragraph A. It seems to be a political statement and a bit negative, and I just to strike the two words more rational would be an improvement to paragraph A. But the comments I would make about the whole policy statement itself would be that in paragraph B, the voluntary nature of a consolidation is something that's important as Duluth teachers views consolidation. It is an issue that I am asked about regularly by our members. There is awareness that there have been moves to consolidate our fund with the TRA in previous years and potentially in future years. So it is an issue among our members. They're aware of consolidation discussions and ideas and proposals in the past. We have opposed some very serious negative consolidation attempts to our fund that would have resulted in the loss of benefits to our members and increasing costs to our employer. So it is an issue that we have some intimate awareness about and some experience with. So my suggestions to improve this statement would be, to leave the voluntary word in paragraph B. I think consolidations should be voluntary the way we view things. Number two, that it should there should be statements to the effect that consolidation should be effected only after a vote of the trustees of the fund, the membership, and the employers of the particular fund that is being consolidated. Number three, that there should be no loss of benefits to protect the employees. I think the employees out there who ask me about consolidation are worried about loss of benefits. In our case, we do have an old plan, is what we call it. It's the only teacher fund in the state that has a set of benefits that we have in this old plan. It's a closed plan. It's for teachers who were hired before 1981. Somewhere between 15% and 20% of our retirees every year use the old plan. So if that were gone in a consolidation, there would be a loss of benefits. So I think the policy statement in any consolidation should protect employee benefits, and there should be some phrase related to no loss of benefits in any consolidation to protect employee rights. And then finally, one of our concerns would be an increase in contribution rates. We are not particularly interested in a consolidation right now, and if it were forced upon us and we were to pay higher contribution rates without a commensurate increase in benefits, I guess we would be kind of wondering, you know, what did we get out of a consolidation other than higher rates, higher contribution rates. So A lot of idea. I guess those four ideas I sort of ticked off there. I can, in short time, I guess, develop some language or some amendments to work with staff or work with the commission to structure some language. Kind of threw a lot out there, but and I don't have any suggestions at the moment to put all that into words. But those are some of the things that we as a board, me and as an administrator, have thought about over the 15 years I've administered the Duluth Teachers Fund. When it comes time to talk about consolidation, it has been an issue that comes up regularly.
Mr. Rice.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I invited everybody that wanted to come to sit at the table at the beginning.
That's all right.
I missed that announcement, so...
That's right, Madam Chair. It's better to...
Join us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Rice, representing Minneapolis Police and Fire Relief Associations. I really was more following the conversation, but Mr. Stoffel's comment, I think, brings me to the witness stand. To address the voluntary consolidation, I mean, I have watched that word closely. This was a word that was put in, I think it was a principle put in 96. I've always understood voluntary to mean an election for members, so I don't know that it's necessary to spell that out, although my clients wouldn't oppose that. I think the word comes from the experience we had with the local police and fire consolidation. I think it's 44 of 48 or 45 of 49 associations consolidated. They were all voluntary. There all was an election involved. There all was an approval by the city councils of those entities, and certainly that's my understanding of what that word is, and I think it was a process that worked well, was uniform, and resulted in good policy and kind of a rational, acceptable process to take a pension plan which many people feel a great deal of ownership in. I mean, they're retired. These are older people, vulnerable people, particularly at this stage of the remaining four that are there, almost all retired, and certainly they wouldn't want to lose their associations without their consent and without their vote. I think there's a history showing that it can happen and has happened. And so if this is an issue that the commission's going to spend more time on, my clients certainly would like to be very involved in any changes in the principles, even if there are additions or things that would clarify it. I would echo and support the comments of Senator Lynch has made and Mr. Stoffel made about I think Minnesota, yeah, we do have the second largest number, but if you eliminate volunteer fire plans, we're down to seven or eight, I think, large plans, which is probably less than the national average. Certainly for a state our size, it's not inordinate. I'd say it is a very rational system. And again, I represent Conn's back in the room, so I'm glad I'm getting up. Now, I've worked with her on the statewide volunteer plan. I think I drafted one of her bills several years ago, worked with Mr. Zickman on. I think.
Do you admit that?
Yeah, I'll do it now. I think I can. There might be some other things I won't admit to working with you, Representative Conn, but that one I will. I would say, though, on this, you know, the Taxpayers Association is here. They recently came out with a report that said, how does Minnesota compare, looking at across all lines of where we spend money on. The one area where Minnesota is way, way below the average is firefighting. We spend 50%, we're like 45th out of 50 states, we spend 50% of the national average on firefighting services. Now, I'm not saying that's because of the volunteer system, but I think one would have to ask, we got the largest number of volunteer plans, and we're way below average on what we spend on firefighting. There are more professional firefighters in Mississippi than there are in Minnesota, and there's like three or four times more professional firefighters in Wisconsin than Minnesota. And why is that? And we're saving money. I'm not saying that's the answer, and I'm not saying you can't improve it and make it efficient, but, you know, maybe there's a rationality there that is deeper than just how many plans are there. And I'm not defending that because I agree with Representative Conn that they should do it. But, and I would agree that Statement A does sound more like a political statement. It's a real negative one. Yeah, there's a bunch of volunteer fire plans. It's there. Maybe it's the tradition of our state for volunteerism. We lead the nation in that. It's the way fire services is organized. Making it more uniform is maybe a good policy. But, you know, those are just some kind of random comments, I guess. But certainly on B, I'd be pretty concerned about that. And I would echo Senator Lynch's comments on C. I think that if you're going to handle these things, sometimes doing it on a case-by-case basis is the best way to do it. And I would point out, at least on one of the facts Mr. Martin cited, that he gave four examples of how the legislature had extended plans. Actually, with the Minneapolis Police Plan in 2005, the legislature shortened it. It phased that plan out when there's 225 members rather than 100, so it went the other way. It made it sooner that that plan would be mandatorily, you know, turned into a trust fund and eliminated. So those are my comments.
Madam
Chair. Representative Kahn.
I understand how the ability to get a pension or some kind of post-retirement benefit has probably been a very effective tool for the retirement of to recruit people into volunteer firefighter departments. But one of the things that seems unlikely is that the fact that they get independence at the effect of a not very rational investment policy. And one of the problems that we've dealt with this, except for with the defined contribution plans, and I think we did this at one time and then kind of backed off to it. You could show that there are a certain number of defined contribution plans where the members were, individual members were losing money because they weren't using the State Board of Investment. I think there are a handful where they're doing better. It's I think I've asked Larry and Ed to get me this information several times in putting it together, and the problem is it doesn't easily devolve into a soundbite, which is how you have to deal with these things. But the basic issue and the problem with the defined benefits plan is that if there's bad investment policy, nobody ever sees it, because the state has a way of rewarding the people who get the lowest investment terms, and if the state doesn't do it, then the locality picks it up. So the individual people never see it. But a system that would put a rational, you know, and probably, my belief is, an improved system of benefits into these volunteer firefighter plans shouldn't be a problem for anybody.
Madam Chair, just on that point, I think one of the things to deal with this is really that you've got the large full-time plans and they have the volunteer plans, and they're really, when you mix the two together, it's apples and oranges or tungsten steel and diamonds. I mean, really, you're talking about two different worlds. And really, having a separate discussion about volunteers and not having those intrude on this, you know, because we have the largest number of plans, because they're volunteer plans, and somehow that should affect the major statewide plans, I think just gets political, it gets confusing, and you could spend a whole bunch of other time on that. One other point I'd make, and, you know, this idea, you know, back when these principles were written, there was kind of a big push, one big plan is all better in 96. Well, around that time, the commission and Representative Kahn, you set up this auditor's report for investment returns. You know, now 10, 11 years later, I think everyone would assume then that the State Board of Investment would have had the best investment record in all those 10 or 11 years. In fact, when I looked, I think in the last 11 years, the State Board of Investment has only had the best return in one, for each year, only one or two times. No doubt they've had a good investment return, but a lot of the smaller funds, Duluth Teachers, I know, in a couple of those years had the best return. St. Paul Teachers had it 3 or 4 years. Minneapolis Firefighters have had it, you know, 4 or 5 years. So there, I think there's an advantage to the state in having a healthy pension community where you do have some other funds that are people who are knowledgeable about pensions. I mean, you've got 5 people at the end of the table here who spend their full-time careers looking at all these issues. Ms. Hacking talked about this big debate that's going on nationwide about liability-driven asset plans. I think we got a great pension system in this state. You've got a lot of knowledgeable people who can give you different perspectives. You've got boards of directors, boards of trustees who take these jobs seriously, who are looking at markets, making decisions. And, you know, I think you want to be a little bit on this whole consolidation that one is better. I don't think is necessarily the best way to do it at all. That, and I think having some diversity and having other viewpoints and perspectives probably enriches the debate, enriches the understanding of pensions in the state, and improves the system rather than hurts it.
Madam Chair.
Representative Codd.
I guess I would just like to second that, because I was one of the people who was converted from thinking we should have only one plan to thinking that having multiple plans to look at each other. And then as an aside to that, I guess I'd like the pension commission at some point, mainly because I don't see any other part of the legislature that would be likely to do it, to look at investment policy and to look at the issue of compare our investment policy with other, perhaps more aggressive ones. I know, for example, at least from the information they send me, the Yale University's investment plan is one of the best returns in the country. And, you know, the question is that too aggressive for a public plan? And is there some proportion that we should possibly put into more aggressive? But I think a meeting on investment policy and comparing it with other investment policies would certainly be of interest to me.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bethel.
And I think we may need to spend some more time massaging some of the language or thinking further. I'd like to head back to, you know, Mr. Stofflet raised a couple of points, and I guess if you want to provide those to us, you know, we'd probably be interested in seeing them. But we have not done a lot of consolidations, I guess, which may or may not be good over the years, but I would hope that if we were to adopt a set of principles that we would keep in mind that there may be some times when we have to act to do some consolidations. I mean, the Minneapolis Teachers Fund was in its death spiral, you know, and we tried to had to do something to save it, and we would not want to adopt some principles that we felt locked into, that where we said, well, geez, we can't accomplish a merger or consolidation or whatever, because we can't get all these things lined up, because sometimes that would not be in anybody's interest to do that. So it might be some good guidance to think of things that we should be aware of, you know, when we're looking at consolidations, but we should not necessarily feel that we're going to be bound by them. And I think the Pension Commission, you know, as we with other principles, when we feel we need to have a need to act, we set the principle aside and we do what we feel we have to do anyway. More often than not. That's why we have this big memo before us.
Madam Chairman, on that point, I mean, I concur with Senator Bethel. I mean, this policy of voluntary consolidation was in place when you dealt with Minneapolis.
Yeah.
I didn't represent Minneapolis, but in the end, I think the fund membership there came to the conclusion that their only lifeline was consolidation, and I believe they did have a vote, and, you know, it worked out, you know, with the policy that was there. And I guess I'd say on this principle, it worked out up until 96, when there were many of those. Ms. Vanek would know the intimate details of that, because she supervised all those, you know, 40-some plans that went in. For the most part, that 86 or 87 legislation that allowed those 44 plans to consolidate with PRA went on well. It was a template. It had only one or two amendments in a 10-year period, and kind of set the stage for what, at least in my mind, the definition of voluntary is and how it worked. And I thought it was a good example, and, you know, it went well. There weren't other plans coming over every year saying do this or do that. It went ahead and worked. Employers weren't trying to change it. Employees weren't trying to change it. So sometimes it's like, if it's not broken, why fix it? And at least in my mind, principle 2B3B is not broken and may not need any fixing. But, you know, there's certainly room for debate on that.
Mr. Stoffel.
Madam Chair, I'll be brief and just echo a little bit about what Brian Rice has just mentioned. In my 4 years, when I was finance director at PERA, one of my major roles was to affect the consolidation of the local police and fire plans at that time. That was a real active period when we were bringing in a lot of the local plans into PERA. And the steps that are in the law to affect the consolidation of a local plan are very thorough, and I think it's a very good model to follow in any kind of a consolidation. In terms of the voting, there's a vote of the membership, there was a vote of the city council, there's a vote of the state board of investment, there's a vote of the para trustees, back to the trustees of the local plan. Several layers of voting, lots of volunteerism in that process, and that's really what I'm getting at. So the more we can have that kind of a process in a consolidation, I think, in most cases, the better. Acknowledging what Senator Betzold said about in certain cases, obviously, there needs to be an expedition of the process and an exception when a fund is in a death spiral. But in our case, I guess that's what we would really look for in a policy statement, those kinds of parameters in most cases.
I do have a question about the current principle. In A, it says that we would benefit from a more rational public pension plan structure. Now, does that assume that the current structure is less rational or irrational? Or, I mean, how would we benefit from a more rational one?
I'm
not quite clear what that means. Yeah.
Mr. Martin?
Senator, it's hard to put my mind back to 1995, 1996, and exactly what the nature of the conversation was. The general way that Minnesota has done public employee pensions has been to cover groups that had the political prominence to demand pension coverage in the first case.
Okay.
So we had a lot of larger city police and fire plans. Eventually a state employee plan, Minneapolis, the MRF plan came slightly before the state plan. The teacher's plan came right just before World War One, right around World War One when Carnegie was pursuing education related pension coverage. We started filling in to other groups on a somewhat catch-as-catch-can basis, which if you look at the years for establishment of the local police and paid fire plans, they run over multiple decades, virtually a 100-year period from the first one created to the last one created. I'm not even talking about the volunteer fire plans, but just the paid police and fire. So we fill in gaps when someone notices that there's a gap and has enough wherewithal to demand that something happen. That may be a rational structure, but I'm not sure one would diagram it that way, that one would necessarily start that way. It certainly follows the incremental way that the legislative process sometimes goes, but it was not necessarily done consistently. Okay. Before the creation of the pension commission, pension policy was set by different entities in each case. Judges' pensions were decided by the Judiciary Committee. Right. The Education Committee decided teacher pension coverage. Local government pensions were established by the local government committee, and that probably didn't lead to a particularly rational way of going at things either. Why we had two competing third-class city police pension plan laws. We only had a first-class and second-class city fire law, but never had a third- or fourth-class city fire law, notwithstanding we had cities of the third class and fourth class that had fire pension programs. So looking at this, I'm not sure you could say what we had and even what we have is necessarily clearly logical and clearly rational. But, yes, this is more of a statement of opinion than a policy position.
Well,
cleanly announced.
Sure. And Madam Chair, Mr. Martin, I mean, obviously, if we're saying we're going to try to benefit from a more rational plan, well, I suppose I'm not going to, who's going to argue with that, but is our goal also in a consolidation and in the benefits to be consistent? Is that something we want to strive for too?
Senator, there are other policy principles that do talk about uniformity of treatment between plans and within plans, which I think, if you take that to its logical conclusion, would be a more consistent plan, at least for like circumstances.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
I think that people have offered to work on, I heard that some people were offered to work on language, and I heard that people want A changed or eliminated from being a negative statement. And so...
Madam Chair?
Representative Conn?
Just specifically on that, if you just took more out, would anyone object? Is more the editorializing word that...
The more rational.
That, and take out also...
How do you define a rational plan, pension plan structure?
Well, I think just by the basic definition of the word rational. Isn't that what the whole policy statement does? I think we've had some discussion which shows that we don't, or at least there's been no legislative movement to consolidate into one plan, but I haven't heard anyone speak against not having, haven't heard 700, 622, whatever the number is, volunteer firefighting plans. And, so I think between those two, there is room for a rational structure. And you may not get to that structure by coercive legislation. You may kind of get there by encouraging people to move to it. But I would object to taking out A. That implies that our structure is perfect the way it is, and that we shouldn't be concerned about the number of public pension plans we have.
Well, Madam Chair, before we... I think, again, that we may need to have some people think about this one and maybe offer some revised language, yeah. But if I could go back to what I suggested earlier, again, balancing the state's commitment to a decentralized government structure, St. Lynch said that sounds political. I agree with that, and that may be a different direction than what I think, but I'm certainly willing to balance a recognition that we have it rather than my commitment to keep that in place. So I like the word recognition more than commitment, but if we're going to be coming back to revisit this.
Okay.
I think we should come back to revisit it, and I invite anyone that has further thoughts on the written language to submit their suggestions in writing before the next meeting. What is the plan's director's comments on Principle 2C1, the defined contribution plan and defined benefit plan language?
Madam Chair, we're comfortable and happy with the language as it exists.
And Mr. Martin, you gave us a proposal on page 11 for changing the language. Last time we heard Mr. Rice say that defined contribution was the biggest mistake that was made for the legislators. For the legislators' pension plan. So I don't know what we want to do with it. But Ms. Martin, you're offering us an alternative.
Well, Madam Chair, what I was doing here is trying to capture what I think was the rationales that have been offered or recognized by the Commission when you have created defined contribution plans. There was some of that in the 95-96 principles with portability, but there, with the shift of various elected officials to defined contribution coverage, that was having to do with probably the length of the tenure that local elected officials or other officials may have. There are other factors that seem to be driving the creation of defined contribution plans, or logically would. So I was trying to capture those in the language. Clearly, the new language suggested on page 11, line 2, the compelling considerations is the out that you have created defined contribution plans for individuals who were previously covered by defined benefit plans, and you must have felt that those were compelling considerations. So I just simply am trying to recognize what practically has happened. The new potential rationales for creating defined contribution plans, at least stated, but implicit in past actions by the pension commissioner, are down on page 11, lines 8, 9, 10, and 11.
I can't remember if I was compelled in 1999, but I must have been, huh? Mm. How about you, Senator?
Compelled?
To change, when we changed from defined benefit to contribution for Litchfield and the rescue squad, I think it was.
Yeah. I don't recall.
You weren't compelled either.
I wasn't compelled, no. But, Madam Chair, I think that it does help to have a better understanding of why the two are different. And I think the language, I think, is more explanatory than anything else on what a defined contribution is. And the reason why I think it helps us to have that understanding is because the issue when it comes up is when people want to go back and forth from one to the other. And we have the situations where somebody was in a defined contribution plan because it was created for those individuals who were not expected to have a long career in the in whatever government service they were in. They were expected to serve a few years and then move on, and this was the only way they could build anything towards some sort of a pension. But for some people, they do wind up going into a career track and want to be able to switch over, and so to have at least the understanding why they were in one in the first place and realize that, you know, there may the basis for switching over to going from, say, defined contribution to defined benefit may explain it. Now, we may want to flesh it out even further to, you know, identify some statement of principle as to when people want, you know, ought to be able to, who are one plan ought to be able to go on the other, because we don't really have any guidance on that. Those are case-by-case matters. Maybe we'd have to focus on, but at least explaining why we have defined benefit and defined contribution, I think, is helpful to me to think of those things.
If I might suggest,
Mr. Martin,
the shift on the legislators and the elected state officers plan coverage to defined contribution was part of the 97 benefit improvements that the individuals on the end of the table compiled, if not promoted or created. So they might best answer the question of why that was part of the initial 97 proposal.
Mr. Bergstrom?
Madam Chair, if I remember correctly, there was concern at the time for the funding of those two plans, and the Department of Finance wanted to stop, I'll use the term, the bleeding in those two plans. Historically, we do not have a legislators or an elective officers fund. The money comes into MSRS, we turn it back to the State General Fund, and there is no pre-funding of the plan. And that is, it was driven more by the reluctance to fund that plan properly than any policy issue, is my understanding, just because they have never pre-funded those two programs. And that's why the Department of Finance wanted to abolish them at the time. So when that package was put together, that was one of the concerns they raised.
Mr. Koppler?
If I might, to Mr. Bergson's comments, I would add, I think the context was established by discussion about pre-funding those programs, in which case you were talking about setting aside somewhere on the order of, you know, $40 to $50 million to actually pre-fund those programs or put us on a schedule to put in significant amounts to do so. And the logic behind pre-funding those programs, maybe for large defined benefit public plans like the states or ours, you do need to fund those things on a pre-funded basis in increments as the service accrues. The liabilities for the legislator's plan and the liabilities for the elected official's plan as a budgetary matter, year over year, if you funded those on a pay-as-you-go basis, or if you funded those on a terminal basis, like the legislator's plan, were not considered significant. So from a budgetary standpoint, unlike civil service employees, where there are just lots more of them, the funding arrangement really didn't seem to compel pre-funding. That was one reason for finance's advocacy for moving to defined contribution for elected officials. The other is had to do with sort of a perception of the nature of the employment. When a person comes into civil service employment for the state or a city or county or as a teacher, I think the expectation is, barring unforeseen circumstances or a change in a person's desire for their career path, the expectation is that they're going to make a long-term commitment there, and they're going to be there a long time. And unless something changes their mind or their circumstances, they will work a full career in that job. The question before the House at the time was, is that the case with elected officials at any level? It may ultimately be the result for some folks who succeed in getting reelected, and who actually want to be reelected. Some people just want to come here and spend one or two terms, focus themselves on a couple of key issues and move on. You've got, you know, term limits for other offices, and the question was, is under the defined benefit plan, was it equitable for people who want to come and work short term to be injured in effect relative to others by not vesting if they didn't get reelected, or should that service be recognized in even increments year by year? And the defined contribution plan recognized that service, however long it was, without vesting, whereas the defined benefit plan did not. So those were kind of the other ancillary issues that were involved. And I think, I don't know, I think from your perspective, the question is what do you think the taxpayer's expectation is? Is it their expectation that most of the people who come to the legislature are going to come here and make it a career? Is it going to be a central part of their income? I mean, is this a career legislature or a citizen's legislature where your primary source of income and your primary profession is elsewhere? How much do you want people relying on their retirement as elected officials? How much of a stake do you want them to put in their longevity in office? That might be an incentive to mediocrity, if you will, and a sort of reticence about bringing forward bold and daring proposals that might be unpopular. Those discussions were had at the time as well.
I remember hearing those discussions. Ms. Salschweiger?
Madam Chair, members of the Pension Commission, Jan Alsweiger, Education, Minnesota. I will speak to page 11, 2C1, paragraph A. And I don't think that the underlined wording, unless compelling considerations dictate otherwise, is necessary at all. I would agree with the pension fund directors in their statements earlier, because these principles are generally what you believe in. And the word should, I think, is key as well. That doesn't necessarily say it shall. It says it should. Your principles should be statements in what you believe, and from what I've heard today, you do believe in defined benefits. If there is a time where exceptions need to be made, believe me, there will be a number of lobbyists probably on both sides to try to compel you to consider something different. So I do not believe that this statement is necessary at all. In fact, I think it waters down what your principles really are. So we would suggest that you do not include that underlying language in paragraph A.
Thank you. Mr. Rice?
Madam Chair, I'll just second what Ms. Allswager says. Because a budget crisis is always a compelling consideration, there is this large debate nationwide about defined benefit or defined contribution, and at least from my client's perspective, I think really we want to have a defined benefit plan. So I'd urge the commission, if it's considering to adopt lines 1 through 12 on page 11, to delete the new language in A. And just a quick rejoinder to my good friend, Mr. Kapler. In 97, the legislature did close the legislative plan to new members. It was an elected group. There was this issue about getting money into the plan, but at the same time, and since then, the legislature has been pretty generous towards the judges' plan. They had a huge deficit, and they weren't funded on a basis. And since 97, you've increased their benefits, and you've increased their appropriations to fund their plan. And I think just as legislators, maybe not for yourself, and it's really hard to sit in that position. It's very uncomfortable because you have to make the decision and face the voters. But as I said before, there's probably a tendency of the legislature to beat up on itself because you're trying to do the responsible thing. You're trying to set the best example. People will always come up and, you know, start to criticize you on things. But I think it's really fair to ask. You had a bill earlier this year from Representative Mahoney because some people did make a career choice and have stayed for a long time. You might have some other people that if the job was remunerative enough and the benefits of great enough, they maybe wouldn't leave. Sadly, Representative Larson is leaving. I think that's a loss to the body. I don't really probably apologize if I'm embarrassing you, but I don't know what all those considerations might be. But it really is, you're giving up to serve publicly. You're giving up an awful lot, and I can say this as a son of a former legislator. You know, it's a big sacrifice, and that's just part of the job. But I don't think in the last 12 years, as I said before, no pay increase in the last 10 years for legislators. For new legislators who started, their pension plan is way less than what it was. I don't think you're quite frankly being fair to yourself, and if anybody can make that point, it's probably got to come from this commission. I know that's really hard. And I would say that you have been generous to other elected officials, judges particularly. They've seen pay raises in the last 10 years. They've seen pension benefit improvements. Not all the time, just because you're an elected official doesn't mean you should take the worst plan. That's simply my point. And again, I think it also adds to maybe Senator Betzel's earlier point, these are principles. And I think you ought to leave yourself at least enough room so that if you have the right circumstance, you don't feel like somebody's going to hold up and say, and the commission violated their policies because they did this, that, or the other thing. Because there are a lot of individual circumstances that apply, and you know, one size never does fit all.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, both fund directors and Mr. Rice, in paragraph B, where it adds some additional explanatory information about the defined contribution plans. Is there anything in there that you see as problematic or not true or that we might regret if we adopted it?
I would take out on lines 9 and 10 where you talk about the positive where the public employee groups consist solely of elected officials. I think the other factors about if they're, you know, it might not constitute a full career where their financial considerations affecting the coverage is such that the creation of unfunded liability should be avoided. Those are certainly legitimate things. But again, just solely picking out elected officials, I don't think that's a fair criteria. I mean, I think that it's wrong. There's other elected, you know, judges are elected. You know, you've done pretty well by them. And there's some elected officials that, you know, it might fit. And I, you know, so I'm not accused. I worked with Senator Betzold earlier on one elected official in Hennepin County who was seeking an exception, It was kind of considered for a while. Ultimately, it was backed off. We worked with Ms. Vanek, and, you know, they're trying to work through. Elected official who started out, and probably everybody who gets elected the first time thinks, I'm only going to do this for a few years. You know, you tell your wife or your kids or you're thinking it, but you could wake up the next day and you've been in the, you've had a long service career, and is it fair to yourself or your family that you've really given up a lot of other opportunities to do it? And I just think it's a factor that at least ought to be considered and not ruled out. And it is, I guess I can't speak for the other fund directors, but I'll try. It's really hard for them to make the policy for the policymakers. You know, it's something that I think the pension commission really are the ones that are in the best position to kind of make that decision. I mean, not the fund directors, but the legislators. And it puts you in a bad spot. I know it does. It just does. And I think, as I said before, I still kicked myself. I can still remember that evening we were outside room 125. I got Speaker Carruthers down. I talked to Representative Jefferson. It was in the Senate bill, not in the House bill. Senator Morris was the chairman of the Pension Commission. I guess ultimately they decided to do it. I think it was a mistake, a personal opinion, and I'm not affected by it. I just think that you look back on the effect that it could have on some other things. I don't think it was a fair result, but that's a personal opinion. So my suggestion to the specific question is I delete just the sole reference to elected officials. The other considerations probably make some sense.
Ms. Pock, or Mr. Bergstrom?
Madam Chair, I have concerns actually where financial considerations affecting the coverage group is such that creation of an unfunded actuarial liability should be avoided. I think all of the pension plan directors would just as soon avoid unfunded liabilities. And that is some of the nature of a defined benefit plan. MSRS at one point was 109% funded. Now we're 90% funded. You know, so I have concerns, including that statement about avoiding creation of unfunded accrued liabilities. I would humbly suggest, maybe to Mr. Rice's point and others, is if you put a period after career, or a comma, or and then go on, or where the defined contribution plan is a supplemental pension plan, rather than expressly talking about elected officials, then the decision is that a career or not can be made by the commission and by the legislature. And I don't know if I want to get into that debate, but I think that would take care of it. Where if you just said constitute a full career or where the defined contribution plan is a supplemental pension plan, would eliminate that, and then the decision would be, is this a career or not, serving in the legislature? But it leaves that policy open. Again, I think fundamentally, you know, the policy should be an overriding factor, and your one of those beginning one gives you flexibility within those policies.
All right.
Madam Chair, I mean,
Mr. Kaplan.
One final point. Maybe only because I spent so much time persuading the governor and commissioner of finance of the efficacy of this change for legislators and constitutional officers. But they found it compelling. That was a big policy decision. And it's something that I think you really, really ought to think hard about as you draft this section, because I don't think that that's the sort of thing, that's not really the sort of policy decision you want to make on the fly. I think it would be good to have it clarified here, whichever way you decide to go. But it's not the sort of thing that I think you want to say context and circumstances will decide, you know, whether elected officials belong in DC plans or DB plans going forward on a case-by-case basis. I think it makes sense for you to have a consistent policy there. And anything else I would say to the point would just be my personal preferences or outlook on the matter, and you don't need to hear that.
We will revisit it. Next time we will do the next three. The chunk will be
chunk.
The next three provisions. Good job. All right.
Okay.
now we have to do. Oh, no, there's still more. The third item on the agenda is the mandated study of retirement benefits. And in our packets, this is in our packets. Is the framework for benefit adequacy study that was presented to us by the fund directors. There's a letter from Ms. Allschweiger. And letter from the Taxpayers Association. And there's the memo of August 6th from Mr. Martin that I asked him to present to give to us so that we would have a variety of choices or things that we have to consider while we're talking about the parameters of and the process that we are going to decide on for getting the report together. Is there the person from, is Mr. Haberman or a representative of the Minnesota Taxpayers Association here? Would you like to speak to your written communication, please?
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, my name is Aaron Twait. I'm the Research Director for the Minnesota Taxpayers Association.
Excuse me, your name again?
I'm sorry. Aaron Twait, T-W-A-I-T.
Thank you.
Research
Twait.
Director. Yes. At this time, no. I don't know that Mr. Haven has deputized me to speak in detail on his letter, but this does make our position, I hope, fairly clear, and I would be happy to bring any questions about the letter to Mr. Haven.
Are there any questions or comments at this time? I would like to have more information about what you're talking about or what Mr. Haberman is talking about in paragraph 4, the benchmark analysis and a comparison to commercially available annuities.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at paragraph number 3, and I'm frankly troubled by a statement in there that says that Any state comparison or benchmarking effort should also investigate relationships between the relative generosity of plans across the nation and the existence of these problems. It seems to me that there's a strong inference there that such plans are overly generous and thus are contributing to any such plans associated with the funds. I think that's a pretty strong statement, and I would like that communicated, Mr. Haberman. Madam Chair, just let me indulge. Our public education institutions across this state face a great many challenges. And unfortunately, their challenges are, I fear, getting increasingly difficult rather than to the contrary. And while I think it's really good and pertinent that the commission undertake this study, I think that it is grossly inadequate to suggest that the problem facing public education is a result of the generosity of the teacher retirement plans.
Anything else?
Well, if you could retrieve further information on those two items, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you for your time and attention.
I know. We have another letter from Ms. Oschweiger. Or the same letter that she sent it when she couldn't be here. But she told us what she wanted in it. Ms. Oschweiger.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allsburg, Education Minnesota, I don't think it's necessary for me to talk anymore. You've seen my chart. In fact, I can get it to you again if you would like. But it is time that we look at it. And now, I mean, the word is that the merger of the active and the post is probably going to take place, and that's going to make it even more important to look at a whole big plan to figure out what we need to do and make it so that these benefits for educators are fair and comparable across the country.
And you want us to look at the form, especially you want us to look at the formula multiplier, high average salary, normal retirement age, taxation of benefits, penalties on early retirement, provisions that call for retirement before the normal retirement age, such as the rule of 90, and the calculation of monthly pension benefit for both early retirement provisions and normal retirement age.
And Madam Chair, I might just add that, you know, we hear that there's a trend to have people work longer, teach longer, and that may be fine. And I think that the statements that Ms. Hacking made about people not using the rule of 90 when they first qualify is because of health insurance, yes. But I think another thing that we often forget is that if we had provisions in law and going forward into the future, such as the rule of 90 for educators after those that were hired after 1989, this is a significant cost savings to districts. When you have a teacher at the top end of the scale retire, and then you hire a first-year teacher or a less experienced teacher, you have a significant cost savings to the district. And I just don't want people to lose that as a concept, because I know that we could talk about comparables and things such as that, but that is something we should keep in mind.
Perhaps add it to the list, kind of cost savings to the district.
Madam Chair, that would be an excellent
Does
point.
Any retirement make?
And if you recall, I think it was in 1994 that the legislative auditor did a report on early retirement incentives. And they came out with a general statement that it wasn't a very big cost savings at all, really, except in one category, and that was in the teaching profession. And so I would encourage people maybe even to look back at that report. But overall, the early retirement incentive was looked at as not a cost savings, but however, for teachers, it was.
94?
Madam Chair, I believe that's when the study was done, when it may have been, I'm not sure. I better not say. I thought it was 1994 because I think it was reported in 1995. That's when I first started. Does that sound right?
Okay, thank you. All right. Ms. Hacking, do you want to talk about this? The framework for benefit adequacy study?
If you like. I have an easier handout to work from.
And Senator, will you take this time, come back?
What's that? One for you? Okay. Okay, I think we have it now, Ms. Hacking.
What I've handed out is just sort of more of a PowerPoint presentation from this written text. Just by way of background, this is something that the three systems worked on together, and it's only in the event you wish to look at benefit adequacy. Not just as a state comparison. It appears as though you want to look at state-by-state comparisons, but this benefit adequacy study would kind of be an additional perspective. And so this is really your decision to make, and the pension funds responded to a question from Representative Murphy to give her our thoughts of how you might frame a benefit adequacy study. So that's what this is endeavors to do. So just to go to page one, start at the very elementary level, and you've already discussed this. In a benefit adequacy study, you have to assume that there are three sources of income that a person might have, a retiree might have. That's their public pension, in this case, from one of the systems, Social Security, plus income generated from private savings that they may have amassed over their working career. Most persons who have studied this issue suggest that a target replacement rate should be in the range of 80 to 90%. And what that just means is in order to maintain a standard of living in retirement that you enjoyed prior to retirement, you would target to have about 80 to 90% of your income replaced by these three sources of income, pension, Social Security, and savings. Now, there's a footnote there to say that there is some debate as to whether 80 to 90% is the right target. Older studies used to talk about something lower than that, more like 70 to 80%. But with health insurance being increasingly a concern and also inflation, we've seen those target replacement rate suggestions drift upward. So for the purposes of this discussion, we're using 80 to 90%, but I want to acknowledge that some studies say you can target for less and some say much higher. So turning to then page three, some of the factors very quickly that affect the target replacement rate are first and foremost health insurance, and we've already discussed that extensively. Another factor is early retirement, and connected to that, longer life expectancies. Basically, the earlier you retire, the longer you have to finance that adequate income over your remaining lifetime. So longer life expectancy, early retirement, means that there is increased risk
as to whether you're going to be able to attain and maintain adequacy. Because with a longer retirement life, you have more risk of inflation, more risk of your private savings, for example, running out or not attaining the investment earnings that it needs to attain. There are very significant differences between males and females. Obviously, women live longer. A recent study showed that women, because they live longer, need to save 2% more per year over their working career to make up for that or to be able to finance their retirement income over their longer life expectancy, which is on average 3 years longer than men. Income level is also important. Basically, lower-income persons need a higher replacement rate because more of their budget is dedicated in the first instance to necessities. And there's a general theory that lower-income persons need to be on the higher end of those replacement rates compared to higher-income persons. Another factor is, of course, inflation after retirement. To the extent inflation is high, that is a big risk that your savings will erode faster and therefore adequacy is harder to maintain in retirement. And then there are lots of life event factors from divorce, health issues, financial stresses, job loss, career interruption that also factor into this that you have to think about. A recent Hewitt study said that considering inflation and lack of health insurance can increase the target replacement rate to 126%, which if you think about it, feels absurd that you actually have to have more income in retirement than you do prior to retirement. But that's how those numbers and those economic factors can have really adverse effects. So turning to page 4, here are some of the assumptions that we are throwing out for you to consider. Again, they can be changed, modified. These are just our thoughts, and actually some of it is based on work that Mr. Martin has done in earlier memos. But you might want to start with an assumption of a career of 30 years of service. This is to test whether we are able to attain adequacy or not. Retiring at the normal retirement age. Again, this is in Pension Commission principles already. And just a reminder that normal retirement age is 65 for someone hired prior to 89, but it's age 66 for post-89 hires. Now, you could test adequacy at earlier retirement ages like 62, 60, 57. As you all have debated and considered, improving the early retirement benefits available to teachers and others, you may want to look at how our benefits stack up at those ages as well. We're suggesting 3 income levels, and these examples that I have here, 40, 60, and 90,000, are probably appropriate for the teacher population, but for state employees and para, those income levels will probably be slightly or somewhat lower, and it should sort of reflect the characteristics of the wage levels in those plans. But I threw out 40, 60, and 90 because that's most likely the TRA levels. We also would consider a survivorship plan of 50%. Most of our members do select some coverage for a beneficiary or a survivor, and so we threw out 50. You could put in 100, you could put in 0, but for purposes of our discussion here today, we selected 50. Continuing to the next page, just a couple of other assumptions that we're using here. We used it a blended average life expectancy as of retirement age. TRA, 70% of our members are female. So we used it a blended rate of 70% female, 30% male life expectancies when we did these calculations. Also, we assumed an accelerated benefit to provide a level income once Social Security comes in. Remember that Social Security benefits are higher for lower wage earners than than they are for hire, and you'll see that in the numbers that I'm going to go through. And then last but most important, there are a variety of assumptions that you can make about earnings potentials, and these numbers make a very large difference in the numbers. But here's what we settled on, is that when you are working, if you are putting aside savings, we're going to assume you can, over a long period of time, earn 7% per year on those investments. Now, some people who are more aggressive could probably earn more. Those who are more conservative would earn less. But that assumption is pretty important. We picked 7. It seemed like a mid-range assumption. Also important is earnings on your savings after retirement. We picked a conservative number here of 3%. Certainly, if you're an early retiree, you might have a fair amount of equities in your portfolio, but as you age, you're going to be much more conservative. So we used a 3% assumption here. You could use 4, you could use 5. It's kind of a debatable thing, but for the numbers I'm going to show you, we use 3. And then to calculate the salary base to apply a savings rate, we were assuming 5% inflation over a person's working career. And again, that you could change that as well. But here are just some sample calculations, and we stamped draft all over this because, again, these numbers can be changed. It really depends upon what you, the Pension Commission, is interested in. But here are some sample calculations that we did just to show you how this works. This first page on page 6 is a pre-89 person retiring in July 1, 2015, so in a few years. We're taking this person at age 65 because that's the normal retirement age, 30 years of service. And you can see the three different income levels, 40, 60, and 90,000 a year. That's their high five. I'll just deal with the first line just to walk you through the calculations. For that person, their combined TRA and Social Security benefit would be $2,937 annually. That gives them a replacement rate of 83%. So in other words, they're kind of close to that target of between 80 to 90% replacement rate. They have a gap of $246 a month that they need to get from private savings. And in order to finance that $246 a month over their retirement life, they'd need a lump sum at retirement of approximately $49,000. Yes, these numbers are big. They're very big. So that person over their working career would roughly need to save between 2 to 3% of their income in order to kind of fill that gap and attain 90%. I won't go through all the remaining numbers, but what you can observe, and I'll go to the last line on that page, is somebody who wants to retire earlier at age 62 with 30 years of service, and let's say they're at the higher income level of 90,000. If you work through the numbers, you see there's a lower replacement rate, partly because they're retiring earlier, so the benefit's lower, but partly because Social Security doesn't provide as much to this higher income person as they would to a lower income person. But the lump sum at retirement that's required is huge. That's nearly $500,000. And that would require a consistent savings rate of 11 to 12% per year. Now, I warn you that if we used that lump sum requirement, if we used a 4% rate of return assumption that you could earn, that number would be lower, and we can give you those numbers. Again, we're looking for feedback from you of what would be constructive. But if you keep going through these pages, you can make some observations, and that is that the savings needed, particularly for somebody trying to retire early under our benefit system, our benefit structure, savings needed are very high, very, very high. And this is this is not unusual. Minnesota is not unusual in that this is a national trend. You've read a lot and heard a lot about how we have an inadequate savings rate in this country, and that folks approaching retirement, many of them are really unprepared for retirement, unprepared for perhaps the lack of health insurance and other financial pressures. And these numbers really kind of try to quantify, well, what does someone need to have set aside by the time they reach retirement age? And to pick up on the earlier discussion, that is why you're probably seeing some people wanting to delay their retirement or look to have another job, even though they have retired. They need that part-time employment to help attain income adequacy in retirement. So I won't go through all these other numbers. They're, you can read them on your own. But I just would close with emphasizing that people, individuals who want to retire early or even need to retire early, really have a big challenge to be able to save the money necessary to get them to be in an adequate situation in retirement.
They have to sell the boat.
And I might add, when that column says lump sum required at retirement, that's not necessarily just cash in the bank or in their deferred compensation account. It can also be savings that may have accumulated in the value of a home, though that's becoming a little less certain these days. But it can be other types of savings. It's not just cash. So keep that in mind. It could be the boat. Is that what you were saying? So.
But I don't know. I think they have to sell the boat no matter what.
And the RV, yeah.
Unless they didn't buy the boat in the first place.
So, again, anything we can do to help the commission, if you're interested in looking at this adequacy question, we are open to other suggestions for assumptions. This was just to set it out as a sample to give you an idea of how the numbers work.
Questions? So, how are we going to proceed? Is the question of the day. On as I've said before, it's my preference not just to do teachers, but to do the people that are in MSSR, MSRS, and PERA also, and the other plans. And so that we know the total implications for all public employees that have been hired after 1989, not lumping them all together, keeping them separate, but having results for each of those groups. And
Madam Chair,
yes.
I'm looking at the minutes, which we didn't adopt yet, but were we going to work on this as part of a committee of the whole? Was that the plan here?
How that seemed to be the wish of the committee
right.
the last time, but
right.
It's hard, but maybe after September it won't be hard
yeah.
to get the committee of the whole or to get the full commission.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to be the folk that the people that talked at the last commission meeting indicated that it was such an important decision that all commissioners should be part of the decision making along the way and the information gathering. But I don't think, like next week, we're not going to have we're not going to have a quorum.
Sure.
So, but I'm still having the meeting.
Well, Madam Chair, I suspect that, you know, we'll have to set aside a meeting and with that as our sole topic. And we've had, you know, obviously the presentation from TRA in here, and, you know, maybe that's the opportunity for everybody who, you know, wants to make their presentation to us, you know, to gather as much information we can. As I indicated earlier, maybe if we can get a date when we get the demographer in here, because that's going to be significant too. And maybe that's our opportunity to listen, and then after we've had a chance to let it sink in, you know, maybe we'll have a better step of what we need to do to have our report in by January, as we're required to do. So, but a listening session, is that what you anticipate? Okay.
Is there anything else we should include? Is there any other information that we want to have in the mix that hasn't already been outlined by Ms. Alschweiger or Ms. Hacking or by the framework or by the Martin memo? Is there anyone in the audience that wants to give advice on what hasn't been mentioned that should be included? Oh, good. We've at least mentioned them somewhere then. Mr. Martin, is there anything in particular that you want to point out in the August 6th memo?
Madam Chair, you had asked me to address the issue of there are other ways to address adequacy. The Minnesota, the Education Minnesota model is to look at provisions of other benefit plans in other states and to compare ours, and we've done some of that work in 2006 and are currently updating that work. Ms. Hacking has picked up basically I cover in page 2 in item D, which is looking at adequacy measures. And so there's some thought roaming around. In thinking about how to compare benefit programs, this would be item 2C. Normal cost is a way of assessing the cost of a pension plan and the value of a pension plan in a numeric way, and it takes into both the provisions and the utilization of provisions. Plans can be very, very generous. Otto von Bismarck was reputed to have set age 65 for the Prussian Army pension program, because almost no Prussian Army member would ever reach age 65, so he could promise a very lucrative benefit and have no one utilize it, so it didn't cost anything particularly. Depending upon how people utilize things, they can have more or less cost. While it's totally infeasible to do it, C talks about if you could take the benefit plan of other jurisdictions and run our membership group through their benefit plan and run their membership group through our benefit plan and see what the actuarial costs and those different configurations look like, you would start to get a feel for relative generosity, relative benefit adequacy of the various benefit plans. And then E is the experiential items, depending upon if a benefit plan presumably is very inadequate, you're going to have people not taking early retirement, working to much later than normal expected ages, other other behavioral attributes which seem to flow, and that should be something of a check at least on other conclusions about relative adequacy. Page 3 gives you our notion about how you ought to go about doing the study in kind of the broadest outline. The first item is to try and get some designer scope. Our decisions worked out. The July 23rd meeting and now this meeting are working on that part of the topic. Then the factual content on which your study, your conclusions would be based would be the next item. We're suggesting beyond the state demographer talking about workforce and our retirement projections and such. Also having either House or Senate research provide some information on the funding of education and what are the projections about the needs for additional funding and what available resources there are, because that seemed to be a large factor in not addressing a benefit increase proposal at the end of the last session, was the lack of means. And so presumably having some notion about that would make sense. Having other entities, be it Education Minnesota or whomever, any information that may be available on that they may have available on the relative benefits provided by other jurisdictions. Jurisdictions vary considerably in whether they include their health insurance coverage on an individual employer basis or if they include health insurance coverage on a total pension fund basis. There are other aspects of pension plan design that don't fit normally within the four corners of what we consider public employee pensions. So it does make these comparisons difficult, and having another approach or another set of eyes looking makes sense. We also have the employer-matched retirement savings thrift plans in the state. It's essentially part of at least potential benefit coverage. We've had these since 1988 or 89, where there's an employer match of money contributed to either tax-sheltered annuity programs or deferred compensation. And you expanded the amount of money that could be put into tax-sheltered annuities or deferred comp from a previous max of $2,000 to a max of somewhere in the neighborhood of $14,000 or $17,000 in the upper end. So that is a defined contribution supplemental pension program that's part and parcel of our pension plan coverage, which we have no regular information collected on. So we don't know to what extent jurisdictions, this is a bargainable item, jurisdictions will vary as to how much they will match, whether they provide the match at all, and then how many individuals in any given bargaining unit actually utilize the match. So it's a potentially, especially now at several thousand dollars potential contribution per year, a fairly significant piece of what could be someone's total pension resources at retirement, for which we have very little information, and I'm not sure how we're going to gain that except by perhaps asking the employee representatives and the employing units to give us some information as to what their experience is, what data they have available, since these tend to be collectively bargained. Just what is the utilization, what is the availability. And then the three retirement systems are apparently thinking about or actually conducting inadequacy study and whatever results they have. So that's two. Beyond, and two will take as long as you have time available and whatever your internal deadlines are set. Once the factual content is gathered, then formulating our conclusions from that is something that the commission would need to do. Four is putting together the actual report document, which would largely be presumably staff-driven. The formulation of commission recommendations would be item five. And then if you're going to translate those recommendations into legislation, which is sometimes the directive in study mandates, but is not, I don't believe is required on this one, but I'm assuming that it's hoped for. Mm-hmm. So if drafting of proposed pension proposals are an item that you want sometime, I would need to be allotted for that.
And finding the money.
Yeah.
We cannot, we have to remind people that whatever the findings are, there has to be a way to fund the proposed recommendations if that's what we're going to do. Ms. Leverins?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to tell you I appreciate and we appreciate your comments about looking at the adequacy of pensions for people in addition to the teachers' pensions, and mostly I just want to be here and be on the record that that is certainly important, that if you're going to look at those pensions, you need to look at the adequacy of the pensions of some of our lower-paid public employees. And I'm going to continue to be on the record to do that, and if I find a magic wand that can create some money for you, I'll let you know.
Good. You could bring the money in, too.
I could do that. I could do that. If the magic wand works, I'll do it. I have a lot of members when I've negotiated contracts who thought I might have a magic wand to make more money, too. So, but I haven't found it in the 20 years I've been doing this.
That's
so
true.
But I mean, I understand your dilemma. I just want to make sure that my folks get taken a look at, too. So I appreciate the recognition of that.
Thank you. Any other comments?
On this topic or in general? No, this topic. So.
Okay. In general.
Well, Madam Chair, the Senate continues its systematic out-transitioning.
You're doing better than...
they're busy running for re-election. I understand that. But we said farewell to Senator Wergen last time. We do have a couple more commission meetings, and I hope that Senator Larson can make them. But we do want to thank him for his service here and recognizing that he will be leaving us by November 5. So I do want to, again, commend him. And I've been telling everybody what a good chair he would be next time when the Senate gets together for the next 2 years. And now, what am I going to tell him now?
Transition.
Right.
You scared me.
But... Senator, we hope that you can be here next Thursday and on the 21st at our next meeting and continue with the principles, but we're going to have more on the study. I think that some of the things we're going to try to do, as Mr. Martin suggested, under the factual content to get a start on some of that. If we can, but we know the demographer can't come, so we will ask him to give us some dates in September by next week so we can talk about the September meeting then after that. I did, in the Governing Magazine, there's this article on public pension prowess, and I found it of some interest. If you have it on your stack of things to read, you might want to read that. And the minutes are before us. Senator Betzel?
I'll move it.
Senator Betzel moves approval of the minutes as printed.
Firm.
The minutes of July 23rd.
Yes.
Any additions or corrections? All in favor of adoption of the minutes, say aye.
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 Opposed? The minutes are adopted. This meeting is adjourned. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, this whole thing. Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Can we try to get House Senate research or something other than education funding?
That'd be good.
Internal folks,
yes.
They probably are more available. Could be made more.
We're heading more. We're parked that way.
I'll start with House research.
Yeah.